40 years old, and Rivka was 3 years old, so Yitzchak certainly married a woman who was much, much younger. But again, I just want to go over the Raya, because there is a very precise proof that Chazal have for Rivka's age, and I want to go over this. And that is the following. We first start off with the idea of how old was Yitzchak at the time of the Akedas Yitzchak. Now, we tend to think Yitzchak was a little child, but in fact, Yitzchak, Rashi proves, was 37 years old. Why do we know this? Because right after the Akedah, we have the death of Sarah. Now, theoretically, you could say maybe the courage of... In other words, the mere fact that Sarah dies, and that's reported after the Akedah, doesn't have to mean she died right after the Akedah. It could be the Torah may skip over many years. Sometimes it does. But Chazal have a Mesorah that the reason Sarah died was that when the Satan told her that Avram was going to kill, or did kill, your only child, so Sarah died out of grief and out of suffering. So Chazal understands that the juxtaposition of Misa Sarah and the Akedah is a cause and effect. She died because of the shock of the Akedah. Some Sfarim give a little different twist. Some say it's not that she died because she thought Yitzchak was killed. Some say her shock was the other way around. When she sees Yitzchak coming back with Avram, she either died out of joy, which is entirely possible, or, this is very interesting, she died out of sadness that she thought Avram and Yitzchak were not Omeid B'Nisayon, that they were supposed to do this, and they chickened out the last minute. And that made her sad, because that shows they weren't keeping Hashem's will, and she didn't realize it was the Malach Hashem that told them not to do it. Now, be it as it may, the following. If we assume, number one, that Yitzchak was Sarah right after the Akedah, we can indeed prove that Yitzchak was 37. And then the proof is very simple. Sarah died at the age of 127. Sarah gave birth to Yitzchak at the age of 90. That's in the Chumash. So if she gave birth to Yitzchak at age 90, and she died at 127, and that was right after the Akedah, Yitzchak was 37 years old. So that's the first step in the analysis. We know the age of Yitzchak. Now, second thing, right after the Akedah, it says that Avraham got news that Rivka was born, essentially, because essentially Avraham had one remaining brother. The brother was Nachor. Nachor had a son, Besuel. Besuel had a daughter, Rivka. So the way Rashi understands it, Rivka was born right then. So if Rivka was born at the Akedah, and Yitzchak was 37 at the Akedah, then when Yitzchak was 40, because that's the age when he married Rivka, she must have been 3, right? So it's a very, very clear proof that Rivka was 3 years old at the time that she married Yitzchak, because she was born when Yitzchak was 37 years old, because she was born at the time of the Akedah. Now, the truth of the matter is, that is not a universal position in Chazal. There is another Shita in Chazal that Rivka was 14 years old, and they learn that although the birth of Rivka is not recorded until after the Akedah, that doesn't mean that's when she was born. That's simply when Avram heard that that might be the right Shidduch. It does not refer, right? So there are different Shitas in Chazal. Some people find it very hard to believe or accept that Rivka was 3 years old. Truth is, people are more mature today, even in Yerushalayim. You see, I see three-year-olds, maybe four-year-olds going shopping in Makolot or whatever it is. So it's not like America, where until you're 18 years old, you really don't do anything. Mom takes care of you until you're 18 or 20 or whatever it is. Here, people are more self-sufficient, and certainly in the ancient world that was the case. But if a person does find it very difficult to accept, at least they should be aware that Tosos and Yevamos does bring a Shita of Chazal that Rivka was already 14 years old. Be it as it may, we do read about the death of Sarah, and the Torah makes the point that she died at 127, and Avram didn't even have a place to bury her. This is a very, very important point. The reason why it's important is, much later, when Moshe Rabbeinu complains, why is Hashem so tough on the Jewish people? Remember when Moshe Rabbeinu asks Paro to send out the Jews. So Paro makes it worse for the Jews. They have to do their own struts, don't make their bricks. And Moshe Rabbeinu complained, Lama hareyoso liyamazah. Why are you so bad to this people? And if you remember the Chumash and the Rashi's interpretation in Parshas Vayera, essentially, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is mochiach, he gives Moshe Musar. And he says, alas for the Avos who are no longer here. Avram Avinu, I made so many promises about Eretz Yisrael, that it was all his land. And when his wife died, he couldn't even find a place to bury her, except he had to buy it for a lot of money. And Avram Avinu didn't complain, didn't question. Right? So this idea that Avram Avinu, in spite of these promises, has to negotiate for a grave, is really considered to be a great tribute to his emunah, his faithfulness, his lack of complaint, and the like. By the way, though, there is an interesting medrash, a fascinating medrash. The medrash says, Hashem knew that there would be three places in Eretz Yisrael that the Goyim would never acknowledge belong to us. Those three places, and therefore, the Torah says we bought them. So we don't just claim it because of divine promise, we claim it because we put down the money. What are the three places? Maras HaMachpelah and Hebron. We bought it. In other words, why do the Jews own Maras HaMachpelah? Not because of divine promises where Christians can say, oh, God changed his mind. Or Islam can say, God chose Muhammad. We're not claiming Maras HaMachpelah because of a divine promise. We're claiming Maras HaMachpelah because we bought it. And Hashem knew this would be a bone of contention. So he wants us to establish our claim by actual financial ownership. The second is the city of Shechem. You will recall later in the Chumash that when Yaakov comes back to Eretz Yisrael, he buys the fields around Shechem for actual money. This is after the Maaseh of Dinah. He actually bought that area. Shechem, you may know, is where Yosef is actually buried. Actually, Shechem was the site of Mechiras Yosef. And Shechem is a very, very violent Arab area. They've never accepted Jewish ownership or sovereignty over there. And the third is the Temple Mount. The Temple Mount was not acquired by Milchama. The Temple Mount was acquired by David HaMelech purchasing the Har HaBayis from a Canaanite, Aravna the Yavusi, Aravna the Jebusite. So the Medrash says that although Hashem promised us all of Eretz Yisrael, but he knew that the three areas that would be contested the most, he wanted us to have a claim that we bought them, and they are Hebron, at least part of Hebron, they are Shechem, and the other Harabais. And indeed, if you look at the modern political situation in Eretz Yisrael, you will see, of course, the Arabs are contesting everything, but these areas, the Harabais and Hebron and Shechem, are the three areas that are the most hotly contested. Yeah.
This area over here, like in English, Damascus Gate, why do we call that Shal Shechem?
You're correct. Shechem is obviously not a translation of Damascus. Anyway, it's called Shar Shechem simply because that was the road during the time of the Bayis. It was from that gate that the road went to Shechem.
Shar Shechem.
The gate towards Shechem. Just like Shar Yafa. Why is the Jaffa Gate called the Gate of Yafa? Yafa was the port of Tel Aviv. The answer was because that was the road. In other words, the roads would go to gates. So the Yaffa road culminated in that gate. The Shechem road culminated in that gate. That's why it became Shar Shechem. Okay? Okay. Now, another thing about Avram, that is, you could see, I think we mentioned the other day, that the fact that Sarah Imenu died in the aftermath of the Akedah could have given Avram a great, great bitterness, because he says, not only was I willing to give up my only child, or my greatest child, but Hashem causes me to lose my wife because of my Mesiras Nefesh. It was a Nisayon, it was like a second Nisayon superimposed on the Akedah itself. Yeah?
Did Avram have known of Tebuah about Sarah's
As far as we know, no. As far as we know, he had no advance notice. He just comes home and she dies. As far as we know, she dies before he even saw her. He did not even say goodbye in that way. She was dead when he came. In fact, it's interesting. This is another question that one could spend a lot of time on. Sarah died in the city of Hebron. That's what it says. The other name for Hebron was Kiryat Arba, which means the city of the four, because there were four pairs that were buried in Maris Machpelah, although that didn't happen yet. You had Adam and Chava, Avram and Sarah, Yitzchak and Rivka, Yaakov and Leah. So even though you don't yet have the four pairs, all you have is one pair, Adam and Chava, but the Torah gives you the name as it will be known in the future. Now, don't confuse this. Today, Hebron and Kiryas Arba are two different cities. Hebron is 95% Arab, with a few very, very either courageous or crazy Jews who live in the middle of Hebron. And people will have different opinions, but certainly the tremendous, you can't imagine the Mesiris Nefesh of living in Hebron. I mean, you're talking about a group, I don't know exactly how many, is it 50 people? It's just a tiny group that is surrounded by 20,000, 30,000 Arabs who would kill them in a second. That's Hebron. Now, across the road, there's a nice, nice Jewish city that has a big security fence and plenty of guards, which is called Kiryat Arba. And this week, by the way, I'm not encouraging you because you never know what happens, but because of Parshas Chayisara, this is the big, big week to go to Hebron. You have thousands and thousands of Jews go to Hebron or Kiryat Arba to visit Maras HaMachpelah on the anniversary of the Parsha where Avram Avinu bought Maras HaMachpelah. So this is going to be a big, this is like, okay, I think about it. This is like Uman on Rosh Hashanah. see, I have to compare Hebron to Uman on Rosh Hashanah. That's how it's become. Uman on Rosh Hashanah is like Kiryat Arba and Hebron for Parshas Chayisara. So I don't know if anyone is planning on going. I've never been there for Shabbos, but they tell me it's a very, very special. Bichlal, Maras HaMachpelah is a very special place. Now, Baruch Hashem, we have the Kaisa, we have the Harabayas, we have the remnant of the Beis HaMikdash, that is unbelievable. We even have the Kever of Shimon HaTzadik, that is a great place, although I'm not sure now how safe things are. But Afal Pin, there's Kever Racha, each place has a unique type of Kedusha. But there's something very, very, very special about Maras HaMachpelah, to be Mispalel by the Avos, by Avram and Yitzchak and Yaakov, and even by Adam HaRishon. And there's something that you really cannot get. I mean, every place has its unique Kedusha. There's something unique about the Kedusha of Hebron. But it is, what can I tell you, it is a dangerous place. So a lot of times, you know, you never know. Trips will be canceled at the last minute because the security situation is very volatile. I remember JLE a number of times going to Hebron. Do they still do it? Okay, good. All right, but being as it may, this is so Hebron and Kiryas Arba in the Torah are the same city. Today, you know, they just call it two different. The Arab part is Hebron and Kiryas Arba is a separate Jewish city. But anyway, so it says, so Avram is obviously heartbroken. And the Pasuk says, Vayavai Avram, Avram came, lispeg lasara, to eulogize Sarah, v'lib kaisa, and to cry over Sarah. It's interesting, eulogy, you know, it must have been a hard thing to eulogize Sarah. Number one, it's hard to eulogize his wife. But number two, he's not necessarily talking to a righteous audience. I mean, imagine this. I mean, imagine, you know, a great gadol dies, a great tzaddikus dies. So we have so many religious Jews who come to the Levaya. And we can talk about Masim Tovim, we can talk about Tzedakah, we can talk about Chesed, we can talk about Torah, and the audience would appreciate that, because it means something to them. Who attended Sarah's Levaya, as it were? Not too many, well, maybe the local population came, but who are the local population? They're Canaanites. They're idol worshippers. So the truth of the matter is, we don't have the text of Avram's Levaya, not Sarah's Levaya, Avram's husband. But I think it's a safe bet that in the course of eulogizing Sarah, Avram Avinu once again was trying to bring people to believe in Hashem. which was Avram's whole life. And therefore he talked about Sarah's emunah, he talked about Sarah's belief in Hashem, with the attempt of trying to be mashpia on them. And the truth of the matter is, even today, by the way, that is actually the purpose of a hesped. A hesped is not only to glorify the Nifter, but it's also to inspire people to follow in the ways of the Nifter, Torah, Yirah Shemayim, and the like. But again, it's a funny thing when you try to picture these things, that Avram is giving a eulogy to people who didn't believe in Hashem, people who were idol worshippers, people who were corrupt in so many ways, people who were dishonest. So he's not speaking to an audience that would understand all of the qualities of Sarah, but he's trying to communicate it anyway. The Netziv has the following ha'arah. What does the pasuk say? Avram eulogized Sarah, and Avraham cried over Sarah. Now the question is, the Gemara in Ma'id Katan says that the sequence is normally the opposite. When you first have a bereavement, you spontaneously cry. And then when you compose your thoughts, you're able to eulogize. Because the first wave of emotion, you can't even think about what to say. So normally, we would expect, he cried and then he eulogized. And yet here it says, he eulogized and then he cried. The Netziv says the following idea. The Netziv says there are two types of crying. The crying before the eulogy is simply an emotional response. I lost someone that I care about. I am devastated. But when you eulogize and you've identified their good qualities, when you cry after that, that is not a crying just out of pure emotion. That's a crying when you objectively realize all of the greatness that left this world. The Kedusha that's no longer here. And that's a much deeper cry. That is not just the cry. Because the truth of the matter is, the first type of crying, in a way, is egotistical and selfishness. Selfish. I'm crying over what I lost. The second crying is when you actually have assessed what that person meant to the world. And therefore, the Torah is emphasizing that Avram's Bechi was not just emotional and egotistical. Avram's Bechi was he profoundly understood that the world was empty, the world was desolate, because Sarah Imenu was no longer here. Remember, Rashi tells us there were three miracles connected to Sarah's tent. Three miracles. And it was connected to Sarah, not Avram. When Sarah died, those miracles went away until Rivka, as a little girl, was brought into that tent. Right, one miracle was that when a candle would be lit for in honor of Shabbos, which they did, it would burn the whole week. And the second miracle was there was a blessing in her bread. You ate her bread and it sustained you for days at a time. And the third blessing was the Shekhinah, the cloud of glory, was over the tent. And the Ramban points out those three miracles existed in the Mishkan as well, in somewhat of a similar form. The blessing in the bread was the showbread, the lechem apanim, that they would bake it Friday and they would put it on the golden table on Shabbos and it remained for a whole week till next Shabbos. And it was warm and fresh. That's the blessing in the bread. The eternal candle, the menorah had one candle that never went out. That's why we have, do we have it? We don't have it. Okay, but a lot of places over up there would have something that's called a Ner Tamid. You know, it's not a chiv at all, but it's a commemoration. In the Mishkan, in the temple, there was a Ner that never went out. That corresponds to a Shabbos candle. And the cloud of glory corresponds to the Mishkan. So what is the Ramban saying? The real Beis HaMikdash was the tent of Sarah Imenu. And those miracles left. So the Netziv says, that's the crying that comes after the Hesped. It's a very, very meaningful Gemara in Brachos. The Gemara in Brachos says, when Rav died, Rav, the Gadol Hador, the greatest of the Amoraim of Bavel, right? Rav, we don't even call him by his name, happened to be Abba, but we don't even call him by his name. He's just Rav, the Rebbe, the teacher. Just like Rav Yehuda HaNasi is called Rebbe in the Mishnah. This is Rav. So it says, at his Levaya, the students carried his body and they ripped their garments because when you have a Rebbe that's a Gadol Hador, that you may have seen, there were people who ripped their garments for Rav Avadja and for Rav Yashif. But certainly if you had a personal connection to such a Gadol, you rip your garment like a father. And they ripped their garments and they buried him. And on the way back, they stopped at the bank of a river to wash their hands and eat bread. They wanted to eat something. It was a long, long procession. And they immediately had a shaila. Since we didn't sit down as a group, I sat down to eat my sandwich, you sat down, can we be mitztaref for a zeman? And we considered a group that we could bench together. They weren't sure. And one of the Talmidim kind of said, without thinking, oh, we have to ask Rav. But then they realized, it happens sometimes, you know, I mean, again, you shouldn't know, but sometimes, you know, you just lost somebody, you wake up, and, you know, your first thought is that you want to talk to them, and then they're not there. So it took them like a second to realize, Rav's not there. So they ripped their garments again, and they said, Rav has left us, and we don't even know the laws of benching. It's like, why didn't we ask him these shaylos when he was alive? You know, how much we would love to have another 5 minutes to ask him these questions that we didn't get to. But we don't have that chance anymore. So this fits with the Netziv's idea. The first ripping was the emotional loss. The second ripping is when they realize specifically what it is that they can't have anymore. Rav Soloveitchik used to say, Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, was the grandson of Rav Chaim. His father, Rav Chaim's son, was Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. He was also a great, great Talmud Chacham. And Rav Yosef Ber used to talk very emotionally about whenever he has a kasha in the Rambam or a Chiddush, he always wants to, he was 70 years old, he always wants to go and tell his father. And he feels like his father is like alive, and then he realizes that his father is not. And you know, it's kind of, he says he goes through that constantly. He had that feeling, and he just wanted to share it. So that is the idea of a bechi that comes after a hesped. The bechi before the hesped is emotional and egotistical. The bechi that comes after the hesped is when you truly understand the person. The hesped allows me to understand what the person is. Now, if you look at the word livkosa, to cry over her, you will notice a little peculiarity. The chaf of libchosa, the chaf is a small chaf, a tiny chaf. That means in the Sefer Torah, it will appear like a tiny letter in the middle of the word. Now, these are halachal Moshe Misina. It's all of these things. The big letters, like Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, is big, right? The small letters, dots, right? There are many, many different things. Dots over certain words, inverted nuns. These are all like strange features, but these are absolutely halachically required. A Sefer Torah is puzzle if you don't have them in there that way. They are halacha, Moshe B'Sinai. We do not have an explanation for a lot of them, so I can't go systematically and give you a reason for every single one. But the Baal HaTurim gives a reason for the small chaf. And this is a strange reason. Libkosa, he cried. But the small chav tells me he didn't cry too much. And he says, because after all, she was an old woman anyway, 127. So, you know, it wasn't like she died young. Very, very strange that would be the reason. I think taking the Baal HaTurim's idea that the small chav means he didn't cry a lot, I think we could give another reason, again, with the Rishus of the Baal HaTurim, and that is, he didn't cry a lot because if he would cry a lot, that may cause him to have tainus and anger against Hashem, who caused her death by the Akedah. In other words, he didn't allow himself to grieve too much, because chas v'shalom, it could have turned into an attack on the Ribon Shalom. And I think there's a lot of sense to that, because the more he would dwell on his suffering, the more he would be thinking, oh, it's connected to the Akedah, Hashem caused this by putting me through the Akedah. But I want to tell you an interesting pshat al pi halacha, which is a little complicated. That is, but this is an important halacha. Well, it's important halacha, although hopefully, again, it should not be nogeya to anybody in Hilchos Avelos. And that is, what is the halacha? We know that Avelis generally has two stages. There is Shiva, the first 7 days of Avelis, and then there's the remaining 23 days that are Shloshim, right? And Shiva is much more strict than Shloshim. And then for a parent, we have Avelis up to a year. But the basic Avelis is Shiva and Shloshim. Now don't be confused. It is not 7 days followed by 30 days. It is 7 days followed by 23 days, because the Shloshim includes the first 7 days. Now, what is the halacha if someone dies and is buried Erev Yom Tov? Erev Yom Tov. Even if it's 1 minute before Yom Tov. The halacha is the advent of Yom Tov cancels the observance of Shiva. To put it another way, we regard the 1 minute of Erev Yom Tov as if it equals 7 days. Now, this is a very interesting point, because it's not only, see, it's more than that, it's not only that it cancels Shiva, but it counts as 7 days towards the Shloshim. It counts, in other words, the 1 minute counts as 7 days. So, yeah. Well, I mean, whatever it is. I mean, if you bury the day before Erev Yom Tov, so you have a 2-day Shiva. In other words, I was giving you the shortest Shiva. In other words, Yom Tov cancels the balance of Shiva. So if you buried 5 days before Yom Tov, you have a 5-day Shiva. If you bury 4 days before Yom Tov, you have a 4-day Shiva. I was giving you a case of minimum Shiva. If you bury on Erev Yom Tov, you just have a Shiva till around an hour before Yom Tov, when you can get ready for Yom Tov. But whatever it is, whatever amount you had, counts for 7 towards Shloshim. So, let's imagine the following scenario. Let's say there's a Levaya Erev Sukkos. So this is tricky. So Erev Sukkos will count for 7 days, meaning you'll observe Shiva for Erev Sukkos, but then Sukkos cancels Shiva. Now, the rule is that Yom Tov cancels Shiva, but Yom Tov does count as part of the 30 days of mourning. So, let's count how many days of mourning would have to be kept in terms of Shloshim. If the burial was Erev Yom Tov, right, so Erev Yom Tov counts for 7 days. Yom Tov and Chol HaMoed count for 7 days towards Shiva. Then comes Shmini Atzeres, which is a separate holiday. So because it is a separate holiday, it counts for 7 days in and of itself. So amazingly enough, if a Levaya is Erev Sukkos, Shiva is observed just until Yom Tov. That counts for 7. Yom Tov counts for 7, which is 14 days. That is 7 days. And Shmini Atzeres counts for 7. So you have 21 days. Now, again, although realistically you only have 8 days, or 9 days, you have part of Erev Yom Tov and 8 days of Yom Tov, but halachically, those 9 days qualify as 21 days, and you only have to keep Shloshim for another 9 days after the Yom Tov. Yeah. Want me to go over that again?
That would be 28. So you have the 8 days of the fulfillment itself.
In other words, no. Here's the thing. Erev Yom Tov counts for 7. Okay? The 7 days of Yom Tov before Shmini Atzeres, they count for 7. Shmini Atzeres is a separate Yom Tov, so that counts for 7. So you have 7, 7, 7, which is 21 days. So there are going to be 9 days afterwards. So the total Avelis of Shloshim is actually only going to be like 18 days, but halachically they count for 30. Now, there is a Mesoira that we find in our davening that the Akedah happened on Yom Kippur. Some say Rosh Hashanah, but there's a Medrash that says the Akedah happened on Yom Kippur. Avram journeyed through a travel 3 days from his home. It says that he and Yitzchak walked 3 days. So, if the Akedah happened on Yom Kippur, and then they went home to Sarah, and it was a 3 day journey, they would have arrived Erev Sukkot. Because Yom Kippur, 3 days, they arrived Erev Sukkot. So, according to this Cheshbon, Sarah Imenu died Erev Sukkot. Sarah Imenu died Erev Sukkot. So, Avram Avinu's Avelus, 30-day Avelus for a wife, would only be 10 days altogether. Because how many days would Avram Avinu have to be an Avel? He had to be an Avel on Erev Sukkot, which is 1 day. And then he'd have to observe Avelus 9 days after Yantif. Yom Tov counts, but you don't observe Avelus on a Yom Tov. So of the 30 days, Avram would subtract 20 days from the Shloshim, and that's why there's a small chaf, as if to say, the 30-day mourning period would be reduced by 20 days. Put it another way, he only kept 10 days, Erev Yom Tov, and the 9 days afterwards. It's a complicated vort, but again, it's based on the idea that if the Akedah was Yom Kippur, and if Avram's journey would be 3 days, and presumably he left the day after the Akedah, because they stayed that day, so then Avram Avinu and Yitzchak traveled the 11th, the 12th, the 13th. They arrived on the 14th. That is when Sarah died. Therefore, if you apply the rules of Shiva and Shloshim, Avram only kept Avelut for 10 days, actually 9.5 days. Erev Sukkot and 9 days afterward, that the Cheshbon of Shloshim would encompass Yom Tov is 7 and Shmini Atzeres is 7 and the like, and Erev Yom Tov counts for 7. So actual observance was 10 days, and that's 20 days less than is normally required, and that is why you have a small chav. Again, this type of our Torah presupposes that the Avos were keeping all of these laws of Avelos, even though they weren't enacted yet. This goes back to the Mesorah of Chazal, that the Avos were following the Halacha even before it was given. Yes?
If Avram showed up Yom Kippur, was it the process of Akedah that would have been certain things
that... I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. Say again, if Avram what?
Was Avraham keeping Yom
Kippur? Was he fasting? The assumption of Chazal seems to be yes, because they make a point that he was baking matzah. I mean, think about this. He was baking matzah because it was Pesach, even though the Jews didn't come out of Egypt yet. But he was doing those mitzvahs. So according to that logic, he would have been keeping Yom Kippur. Yeah, that's correct. But on Yom Kippur, you're allowed to bring sacrifices, as we know. So Yitzchak could be the Yom Kippur sacrifice. Yeah.
He was speaking about Sarah and Menu, and he was saying that the Satan came and told her that that's what he said, and she passed away. Was that a failing on her part, or was that just a natural conclusion to her life?
Well, it depends how you understand it. If she passed away because she thought they failed the test, then it would not be a failing on her part. It would be how strong she was in her faith that it destroyed her, that she thought they were not up to that madrega. Now, if she passed away because of grief, I don't think we look at that. We don't look at that as a failing. I mean, a mother has natural love, meaning to say, it's not that she's unhappy that this happens. In other words, that they fulfilled the will of God, but naturally it affects a person. A person is a.
I was asking because of the default that it's the Satan, there's a negative force that comes to tell her that's the news.
Yeah.
And she adhered to the news regardless of more or less the interpretation of the news.
Yeah.
I was wondering if that's in such a way makes it seem like it was some kind of a failing on her part.
It doesn't seem to be a complaining. It doesn't say that she complained. She just died of the shock itself. And indeed, some say she died of the joy that her husband and son fulfilled the will of Hashem. So it was a joyous death, a death of transcendence and the like. Okay, we'll stop here. Wish you all good. Good Shabbos.